Robben Island was only a league dead ahead, and as the bay opened before them, they could make out the Gull lying on the moonlit waters. "Hoist a lantern to the masthead," Cumbrae ordered, "and we'll put a wee stretch of water between us before the cheeseheads in the fort rub the sleep out of their eyes." As the lantern went aloft, the Gull repeated the signal to acknowledge. Then she hoisted her anchor and followed the prize out to sea. "There's bound to be a good breakfast in the galley," Cumbrae told his men. "The Dutchies know how to tend their bellies. Once you have them locked neatly in their own chains, you can try their fare. Bosun, keep her steady as she goes. I'm going below to have a peep at the manifest and find what we've caught ourselves." The Dutch officers were trussed hand and foot, and laid out in a row on the deck of the main cabin. An armed seaman stood over each man. Cumbrae shone the lantern in their faces and examined them in turn. The big warlike officer lifted his head and bellowed up at him. "I pray God that I live to see you swinging at the rope's end, along with all the other devil-spawned English pirates who plague the oceans." It was obvious that he had fully recovered from the blow to the back of his head. "I must commend ye on your command of the English language," Cumbrae told him. "Your choice of words is quite poetic. What is your name, sir?"
"I am Colonel Cornelius Schroeder, in the service of the Dutch East India Company."
"How do you do, sir? I am Angus Cochrane, Earl of Cumbrae."
"You, sir, are nothing but a vile pirate."
"Colonel, your repetitions are becoming just a wee bit tiresome. I implore you not to spoil a most promising acquaintanceship in this manner. After all, you are to be my guest for some time until your ransom is paid. I am a privateer sailing under the commission of His Majesty King Charles II. You, gentlemen, are prisoners of war."
"There is no war," Colonel Schroeder roared at him scornfully. "We gave you Englishmen a good thrashing and the war is over. Peace was signed over 2 months ago."
Cumbrae stared at him in horror, then found his voice again.
"I do not believe you, sir."
Suddenly he was subdued and shaken. He denied it more to give himself time to think than with any conviction. News of the English defeat at the Medway and the Battle of the Thames had been some months old when Richard Lister had given it to him. He had also reported that the king was suing for peace with the Dutch Republic. Anything might have happened in the meantime.
"Order these villains of yours to release me, and I will prove it to you."
Colonel Schroeder was still in a towering rage, and Cumbrae hesitated before he nodded at his men.
"Let him up and untie him," he ordered.
Colonel Schroeder sprang to his feet and smoothed his rumpled moustache as he stormed off to his own cabin. There he took down a silk robe from the head of his bunk. Tying the belt around his waist, he went to his writing bureau and opened the drawer. With frosty dignity, he came back to Cumbrae and handed him a thick bundle of papers. The Buzzard saw that most were official Dutch proclamations in both Dutch and English, but that one was an English news sheet. He unfolded it with trepidation and held it at arm's length. It was dated August 1667. The headline was in heavy black type, 2 inches tall. "Peace signed with the Dutch Republic." As his eye raced down the page, his mind tried to adjust to this disconcerting change in circumstances. He knew that with the signing of the peace treaty, all letters of marque issued by either side in the conflict had become null and void. Even had there been any doubt about it, the third paragraph on the page confirmed it. "All privateers of both combatant nations, sailing under commission and letters of marque, have been ordered to cease warlike expeditions forthwith and to return to their home ports to submit themselves to examination by the Admiralty Assizes." The Buzzard stared at the news sheet without reading further, and pondered the various courses of action open to him. The Swallow was a rich prize. The good Lord alone knew just how rich. Scratching his beard, he toyed with the idea of flouting the orders of the Admiralty Assizes, and hanging on to it at all costs. His great-grandfather had been a famous outlaw, astute enough to back the Earl of Murray and the other Scottish lords against Mary, Queen of Scots. After the Battle of Carberry Hill, They had forced Mary to abdicate and placed her infant son James upon the throne. For his part in the campaign, his ancestor had received his earldom. Before him, all the Cochranes had been sheep thieves and border raiders, who had made their fortunes by murdering and robbing not only Englishmen, but members of other Scottish clans as well. The Cochrane blood ran true. So the consideration was not a matter of ethics. It was a calculation of his chances of getting away with his prize. Cumbria was proud of his lineage, but also aware that his ancestors had come to prominence by adroitly avoiding the gibbet and the hangman's ministrations. During this last century, all the seafaring nations of the world had banded together to stamp out the scourge of the corsair and the pirate that, since the times of the pharaohs of ancient Egypt, had plagued the commerce of the oceans.
"He'll not get away with it, laddie,"
he decided silently, and shook his head regretfully. He held up the news sheet before the eyes of his sailors, none of whom was able to read.
"Och, it seems the war is over. More's the pity of it. We'll have to set these gentlemen free."
"Captain, does this mean that we lose out on our prize money?" the coxswain asked plaintively.
"Unless you want to swing from the gallows at Greenwich Dock for piracy, it surely does."
Then he turned and bowed to Colonel Schroeder.
"Sir, it seems that I owe you an apology."
He smiled ingratiatingly. "It was an honest mistake on my part, which I hope you will forgive. I have been without news of the outside world these past months." The colonel returned his bow stiffly, and Cumbrae went on.
"It gives me pleasure to return your sword to you. You fought like a warrior and a true gentleman."
The colonel bowed a little more graciously. "I will give orders to have the crew of the ship released at once. You are, of course, free to return to Table Bay, and to continue your voyage from there.
Whither were you bound, sir?" he asked politely. "We were on the point of sailing for Amsterdam. Before your intervention, sir, I was carrying letters of ransom to the Council of the VOC on behalf of the governor-designate of the Cape of Good Hope, who, together with his saintly wife, was captured by another English pirate, or rather," he corrected himself, "by another English privateer."
Cumbrae stared at him.
"Was your governor-designate named Petrus van der Velder? And was he captured on board the company ship, the Standfasticate?" he asked. "And was his captor an Englishman, Sir Francis Courtney?"
Colonel Schroeder looked startled.
"He was indeed, sir. But how do you know these details?"
"I will answer your question in due course, Colonel. But first I must know, are you aware that the Standfasticate was captured after the peace treaty was signed by our two countries?"
"My lord, I was a passenger on board the Standfasticate when she was captured. Certainly I am aware that she was an illegal prize."
"One last question, Colonel. Would not your reputation and professional standing be greatly enhanced if you were able to capture this pirate Courtney, to secure by force of arms the release of Governor van der Velder and his wife, and to return to the treasury of the Dutch East India Company the valuable cargo of the Standfasticate?"
The colonel was struck speechless by such a magnificent prospect. That image of violet-coloured eyes and the hair like sunshine, which, since he had last looked upon it, had never been far from his mind, now returned to him in every vivid detail. The promise that those sweet red lips had made him outweighed even the treasure of spice and bullion that was at stake. How grateful the Lady Katinka would be for her release, and her father also, who was president of the governing board of the VOC. This might be the most significant stroke of fortune that would ever come his way. He was so moved that he could barely manage a stiff nod of agreement to the buzzard's proposition.
"Then, sir, I do believe that you and I have matters to discuss that might redound to our mutual advantage," said the buzzard, with an expansive smile.
The following morning, the Gull and the Swallow sailed in company back into Table Bay, and as soon as they had anchored under the guns of the fort, the colonel and Cumbrae went ashore. They landed through the surf, where a party of slaves and convicts waded out shoulder-deep to drag their boat up the beach before the next wave could capsize it, and stepped out onto dry land without wetting their boots. As they strode together towards the gates of the fort, they made a striking and unusual pair. Schroeder was in full uniform, his sashes, ribbons, and the plumes of his hat fluttering in the southeaster. Cumbrae was resplendent in his plaid of red, russet, yellow, and black. The population of this remote way station had never seen a man dressed in such garb, and crowded to the verge of the unpaved parade ground to gape at him. Some of the doll-like Javanese slave girls caught Cumbrae's attention, for he had been at sea for months without the solace of feminine company. Their skin shone like polished ivory, and their dark eyes were languid. Many had been dolled up in European style by their owners, and their small, neat bosoms were jaunty under their lacy bodices. Cumbrae acknowledged their admiration like royalty on a progress, lifting his beribboned bonnet to the youngest and prettiest of the girls, reducing them to titters and blushes with the bold stare of his blue eyes over the fiery bush of his whiskers. The sentries at the gates of the fort saluted Schroeder, who was well known to them, and they went through into the interior courtyard. Cumbrae glanced around him with a penetrating eye, assessing the strength of the defences. It might be peace now, but who could tell what might transpire a few years from now? One day he might be leading a siege against these walls. He saw that the fortifications were laid out in the shape of a five-pointed star. Clearly, they had as their model the new fortress of Antwerp, which had been the first to adopt this innovative ground plan. Each of the 5 points was crowned by a redoubt, the salient angles of which made it possible for the defenders to lay down a covering fire on the curtain walls of the fort, which before would have been dead ground and indefensible. Once the massive outer walls of masonry were completed, the fort would be well nigh impregnable to anything other than an elaborate siege. It might take many months to sap and mine the walls before they could be breached. However, the work was far from finished. Gangs of hundreds of slaves and convicts were labouring in the moat and on top of the half-raised walls. Many of the cannon were stored in the courtyard and had not yet been sighted in their redoubts atop the walls overlooking the bay. "Oh, an opportunity lost," the buzzard wailed. This intelligence had come to him too late to be of profit. "With another few knights of the order to help me, Richard Lister and even Frankie Courtney, before we fell out, I could have taken this fort and sacked the town. If we had combined our forces, the three of us could have sat here in comfort, commanding the entire southern Atlantic and snapping up every Dutch galleon that tried to round the Cape." As he looked around the courtyard, he saw that part of the fort was also used as a prison. The file of convicts and slaves in leg irons was being led up from the dungeons underneath the northern wall. Barracks for the military garrison had been built above these foundations. Although piles of masonry and scaffolding littered the courtyard, a company of musketeers in the green and gold doublets of the VOC was drilling in the only open space in front of the armoury. Ox-drawn wagons, heavily laden with lumber and stone, rumbled in and out of the gates, or cluttered the yard, and a coach, standing in splendid isolation, waited outside the entrance to the south wing of the building. The horses were a matching team of greys, groomed so that their hides gleamed in the sunlight. The coachman and footman were in the green and gold company livery. "His Excellency is in his office early this morning. Usually we don't see him before the noon," Schroeder grunted. "News of your arrival must have reached the residence." They went up the staircase of the south wing and entered through the teak doors, with the company crest carved into them. In the entrance lobby, with its polished yellow wood floors, an aide-de-camp took their hats and swords and led them through to the antechamber. "I will tell His Excellency that you are here," he excused himself as he backed out of the room. He returned in minutes. "His Excellency will see you now." The governor's audience room overlooked the bay through narrow slit windows. It was furnished in a strange mixture of heavy Dutch furniture and oriental artefacts. Flamboyant Chinese rugs covered the polished floors, and the glass-fronted cabinets displayed a collection of delicate ceramic ware in the distinctive and colourful glazes of the Ming dynasty. Governor Kleinhans was a tall, dyspeptic man in late middle age, his skin yellowed by a life in the tropics, and his features creased and wrinkled by the cares of his office. His frame was skeletal, his Adam's apple so prominent as to seem deformed, and his full wig too young in style for the withered features beneath it.
"Colonel Schroeder," he greeted the officer stiffly, without taking his faded eyes in their pouches of jaundiced skin off the buzzard. "When I woke up this morning and saw your ship was gone, I thought that you had sailed for home without my leave."
"I beg your pardon, sir. I will give you a full explanation. But may I first introduce the Earl of Cumbrae, an English nobleman?"
"Scots, not English," the buzzard growled.
However, Governor Clainhans was impressed by the title and switched into good grammatical English, marred only slightly by his guttural accent.
"Ah, I bid you welcome to the Cape of Good Hope, my lord. Please be seated. May I offer you a light refreshment? A glass of Madeira, perhaps?"
With long-stemmed glasses of the amber wine in their hands, their high-backed chairs drawn up in a circle, the colonel leaned towards Clainhans and murmured,
"Sir, what I have to tell you is a matter of the utmost delicacy."
And he glanced at the hovering servants and aide-de-camp.
The governor clapped his hands, and they disappeared like smoke on the wind. Intrigued, he inclined his head towards Schroeder.
"Now, colonel, what is the secret that you have for me?"
Slowly, as Schroeder talked, the governor's gloomy features lit with greed and anticipation. But when Schroeder had finished his proposition, he made a show of reluctance and scepticism.
"How do we know that this pirate Courtney will still be anchored where last you saw him?" he asked Cumbrae. "As recently as 12 days ago, the stolen galleon, the Stand Wastahate, was careened upon the beach with all her cargo unloaded and her mainmast unstepped. I am a mariner, and I can assure you that Courtney could not have had her ready for sea again within 30 days. That means that we still have over 2 weeks in which to make our preparations and to launch our attack upon him," the buzzard explained.
Clainhans nodded. "So whereabouts is the anchorage in which this rascal is hiding?" The governor tried to make the question casual, but his fever-yellowed eyes glinted.
"I can only assure you that he is well concealed."
The buzzard sidestepped the question with a dry smile.
"Without my help, your men will not be able to hunt him down."
"I see." With his bony forefinger, the governor picked at his nostril, then inspected the flake of dried snot he had retrieved. Without looking up, he went on, still casually.
"Naturally, you would not require a reward for thus performing what is, after all, merely your bounden and moral duty to root out this pirate's nest." "I would not ask for a reward, other than a modest amount to compensate for me for my time and expenses," Cumbrae agreed.
100th part of what we are able to recover of the galleon's cargo," Clainhans suggested.
"Not quite so modest," Cumbrae demurred.
"I had in mind half."
"Half?"
Governor Clainhans sat bolt upright, and his complexion turned the colour of old parchment.
"You are jesting, surely, sir?" "I assure you, sir, that when it comes to money, I seldom jest," said the buzzard. "Have you considered how grateful the Director General of your company will be when you return his daughter to him unharmed, and without having to make the ransom payment? That alone would be a compelling factor in augmenting your pension, without even taking into account the value of the cargo of spice and bullion."
While Governor Clainhans considered this, he began to excavate his other nostril and remained silent. Cumbrae went on persuasively.
"Of course, once Van der Velde is released from the clutches of this villain and arrives here, you will be able to hand over your duties to him, and then you will be free to return home to Holland, where the rewards of your long and loyal service await ye."
Colonel Schroeder had remarked on how avidly the governor was looking forward to his imminent retirement after 30 years in the company's service. Clainhans stirred at such an inviting prospect, but his voice was harsh. "A tenth of the value of the recovered cargo, but not to include the value of any pirates captured and sold on the slave block. A tenth, and this is my final offer."
Cumbrae looked tragic. "I shall have to divide the reward with my crew. I could not consider a lesser figure than a quarter."
"One-fifth," grated Clainhans.
"I agree," said Cumbrae,
well content.
And, of course, I will need the services of that fine naval frigate anchored in the bay, and three companies of your musketeers, with Colonel Schroeder here to command them. And my own vessel needs to be replenished with powder and cartridge, not to mention water and other provisions.